When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.
They tried to colonize us, tried to genocide us, yet we're still here with the tongue unbroken. Welcome, folks, to the Tongue Unbroken. This is episode 11. I'm super excited because we are reaching across what we call Yeltuch, which is Raven Black, I guess is how that translates, and Eitini Kanach, so across the ocean to a dear friend and relative. It's been 5 years since we've seen each other. We both do language work, and I'm excited to have a conversation with Iene Vini in Aotearoa, working in the Maori language, and is working on a podcast of his own. So I'm excited today to go international. We're going across the waters. We're going across time. It's tomorrow for him. And so I'm excited to just visit with you for a bit and hear what you've been up to and what's going on over there. I just want to recognize the Maori peoples as an origin point for so much stuff for global language reclamation movements. The Languageness movement has its origins in New Zealand and among the Maori people, and the Hawaiians saw it and replicated it. And then we've been studying with the Hawaiians when we've been replicating what they've been trying to do. And so I just want to give a lot of chusachan, a lot of love to your peoples and to your side of the world. And why don't you tell the people who you are and about a little bit of your language journey.
Kone kanak jish, tēnā koutou e whakarongo mai ana ki tōku reo, e tika ana te kōrero, ko tēnei hononga nei kei Wainganui a tāu i a tātou, he hononga rangatira no reira tēnei mihi atu ana ki a koutou katoa. Hiko te uira ki rungo o kōpu kai roa, papā te whatitiri ki rungo o maunga mana. Whakapapa pounamu te tahuna o rangatau wa ki karikari te tero te waitao i whakanukunuku hia i whakanekeneke hia ki taiwiwi, ki taiwa wā, ki taipapa ki one pū. Tihei mauri ora. Good morning, everybody. Hune, thank you so much for giving me some space in your podcast to talk about some things with your listeners. So a big thank you to you, and thank you to everyone listening. But also, it's just so nice to see you after so long. I have such incredible memories from my time visiting the Indigenous people of Alaska in 2019, and I can't wait to get back. But thank you so much. The hospitality, I felt so at home over there, and I think for that, I've just felt the since. Like, I really want to get back over and see you all in person. But for now, it's great. I'm dialing in from Wainui Omata, Wellington, Aotearoa. The greater Wellington area is quite big, and Wainui Omata is a part of that, a smaller city called Lauahat. My name is Vincent, Vinny. My Māori name is Ieni. And the little speech that I opened with just at the beginning there is a tauparapara, and it's from home. And there's kind of a little saying that if you can understand our tauparapara, our ways of introducing ourselves in our ancestral spaces, then you get to know us pretty quick. So the place names that I listed are around the land that I come from, in the Tauranga region of the North Island of New Zealand. And all of those place names are the places that it's lovely to spend some time with. And looking forward to our chats.
Sheesh. Yeah, so we were hanging out in the Kenai area in Dena'ina country in 2019. The Alaska Native Studies Council had gotten some funding to do two sessions. One session was language specific, and we brought you over and Keiki Kawai'ea from Hilo, and just had a wonderful time talking about languages and planning and what we can do. We had probably 20 or 30 folks from all over Alaska who were there, some of them who have language schools and programs built, and some who have maybe fewer than 10 speakers remaining. It was a really diverse group of people in terms of their backgrounds and what they're working on in their languages. And it was just a wonderful time. We had incredible weather. We had people who took us out onto the land for a bit. We went hiking down by the water. And so it was really wonderful. And it was really great to meet you and to see some of the things that you're doing and working on. And then after that, we had a session maybe a month or two later with Graham and Linda Smith. And they came to Anchorage, and we got into this little cabin and just brainstormed on how to possibly decolonize a university, which is... It might not be possible sometimes, and maybe it is possible, but it is a journey. It is work. At our university, we have some people who sometimes whisper to in meetings that maybe we shouldn't even be using the word decolonization. And so that to me tells me we've got a ton of work to do. But thinking of language journeys and thinking of things that unite us, because we're on the opposite sides of the world, and there's some things we have in common. We all met this dude named Cook who floated around in a boat and apparently buried coins somewhere and would like say, now that land belongs to the king or the queen or whoever. And so we've seen some colonizers, some of the same ones, and we've also seen colonization through a real similar process and through various forms of language restriction and also attempted cultural genocide and taking of land, taking of resources, abuse of people. But I think more importantly, the things that unite us now is this reclamation of time and space for our identity and for our languages. So I started learning Tlingit when I was about 20. On my father's side, I'm also Yupik and Sami, and there were Yuchtin speakers in my family. There were Sami speakers in my family, if you go back. Tlingit speakers go back to only my grandparents' generation, and then Haida speakers, same thing. So I'm Tlingit, Haida, Yupik, and Sami. And so when I turned 20, I started to learn Tlingit and also started to realize just how endangered languages are around the world. My focus started with North America, but then I started to sort of look globally. And when you look globally, there's a lot of things that point towards Aotearoa and the things that have happened there. So could you share a little bit about your individual language journey and also the journey of your peoples?
Kia ora kone. I didn't actually realize that you yourself had pursued your language as an adult, and I resonate with that, having started my own language journey at age 18 when I entered my university and decided to start studying it there. So that was my language trajectory, and so I really resonated with your kōrero about indigenizing universities, because that is weirdly, strangely, the space that I began to sort of foray into the world of indigeneity. So I entered Victoria University of Wellington, Te Heringa Waka, at aged 18 in 2008, and I went to enroll in a music program. And I really liked the idea of being a musician, and I wanted to study jazz, and it was beautiful. And I had a free space in my first trimester, and I could fill that with language. I've always wanted to find out a little bit more about my ancestry. I hadn't really participated in my culture at all up until that point. I grew up with my mother, my wonderful mother and her own mother who were English speaking, and that's where I spent most of my time. My father's side, there was some Māori language spoken. I remember hearing it at some family gatherings, but not in a very big way. And so I never really thought about it all that much until I got into that sort of 17, 18-year-old frame of mind. And I think naturally a lot of us start questioning a lot. We start questioning a lot of our peers, of our teachers at school, of the adults in our lives. And I'd had some experiences that kind of showed me, actually, I'm not sure these adults really know what they're doing. I'm not sure they really understand what they're talking about. And so some of the negative things that I'd hear about Māori people and Māori culture, I started wondering, is that really true? I'm not sure that's true. It's not very representative of my world. It's not very representative of the only other one. But I'm going to go and find out. And so I enrolled in my first Māori language course in 2008 and absolutely fell in love with this language to the point that I dropped out of music and just followed te reo Māori, Māori culture at my institution and just did those as core courses. And I think I learned a couple of things pretty quickly about the trajectory of Māori, which, as you say, is not unlike your own language. A couple of things I learned were we had a really intense and quick period of loss for our language. It was possibly within a generation or so. I had always been taught up until that point that my people sort of gave the language away, you know, that we just kind of thought, oh, that English, that looks pretty cool. Like you say, that cook guy who seems pretty cool, we might just like rock over there and do what he's doing. It was quite confronting to learn about actually the education system, even the European education system established here in 1816, was purely Māori speaking. You go, hang on, I thought they came in like they used the education system to colonize Māori, but they were Māori speaking? I didn't learn that is true. They did use the education system, but they started it in te reo Māori, sort of gestured it towards English over a period of time. They did the same thing with broadcasting, although back in the day it was newspapers. They were all being written in te reo Māori. Even Westminster government, when all of those things were being done, they were being done in Māori at the outset, and then very slowly changed into being English. And I think that taught me the quest of colonialism at the time was to be a little more covert. And so that trajectory in Aotearoa, a lot of it feels covert. And my observations of other language backgrounds around the world, that sometimes it was more overt. That has meant that here we've had to think quite deeply about unpacking, like what is actually going on here, because it's quite hard to tell. So that was one thing I learned pretty quick was A, what I had learned when I was growing up hadn't actually happened like that, but B, it had been this kind of subterfuge over a period time. And I guess one other thing that I learned, which was surprising, is I had actually thought that I was the only Māori person who couldn't speak Māori, I thought. And it was just me, just my sister and I, you know, we're the only ones who couldn't, and literally everybody else could. They just didn't. That was my assumption. It wasn't until I got into class that I realized that 96% of the nation has no Māori language skills whatsoever beyond a couple of words. And I was sort of part that 96. But there was hope in that for me. And there was hope in that once I understood that I wasn't alone, that everybody in this room was here with me. They were on my journey. And that we could become part of 4%. And that if enough of us became part of that 4%, we could become part of the whatever percent comes next. And so I felt hope in that. And so while learning about all of the things that happened here, I think it was an episode that you had with Ray Taken Alive and Dr. Walkie. Those two episodes are very reminiscent of New Zealand, loss of language and the experience, some of the schooling experiences, very reminiscent. And so I learned about all those things while at the same time seeking these little elements of hope. And it's been the hope that I've clung to in difficult times.
Cheers for sharing. Yeah, and I can relate to so much of what you just shared with us. And so one of them is having sympathy for the adults, because I pretend like I know what I'm doing. We have a verb, it's outlier, which is Well, they pretended like they knew what they were doing, but they didn't really know what they were doing. And the neat thing about it is the verb root for that is raven. And I feel like that probably 90% of the time. It's like, okay, well, I'll just act like I know what I'm doing. And so especially when you get into the realm of language teaching and language learning, and there's so much depth to indigenous languages, and there's so much that needs to be done to replace what we have lost. And so among the Thlinkit people, we have maybe 100 people who can speak our language. If you just said, okay, well, who could just function entirely in the language? It probably gets down to fewer than 20. And then if you said, well, who could do everything in the language, like the old people used to do a long time ago, and it's about 7. And so these are critical times for us. And sometimes we are making moves and we are building motivation, but it's such a thing, like the tide goes up and back down, but it seems to be going lower every time. And so sometimes at a high tide kind of level, metaphorically, people will feel really good. And they'll stand up at some of the meetings of our Indigenous leadership here, and they'll say, I'm so glad we almost lost everything. And now we're in a good, safe space, you know, and I'll just look around the room thinking, what is this space? Where does it exist? Because I'm panicking every single day. And so, but I think also, as you were saying, if you have 4%, like for us, it's probably, I would say, fewer than 0.5% of Tlingit people can speak their own language. And so it's probably similar numbers for our neighboring folks around us, like Tsimshian and Haida peoples. And so to try and transform those things, because colonization is so sneaky and tricky, like it's deeper than some of the things that we might even imagine. Like, as you're saying, some of these things that you just sort of are taught. And like, I don't remember ever hearing in school what happened to indigenous languages, but I remember coming out with some assumptions, and I don't know where those come from. Like, oh, I guess people just stopped speaking. Or I guess, and there's a lot of people who live on our lands who would probably say the same thing. Oh, they just, it wasn't useful, so they stopped speaking it. But it's so interesting because I don't think teachers have to actively teach like that anymore. It's sort of deeply ingrained into the fabric of the colonial society. And so as we embrace decolonization and as we embrace language reclamation, it's a constant tug and pull between trying to raise awareness and then try not to make people feel too bad because they're not doing enough right now. And so it's tricky business to sort of say, okay, can we get to 1%? And then can we get to 2, then to 3, then to 4? Because for us, we have most of the speakers that I worked with a lot as my fluency was really in a climbing stage over the past 10 years, especially, they were all in their 90s. And so I knew when I was working with them, I had such a limited time. So I would just keep asking questions and say, translate this, do all this, do all that. And I'm so thankful that they did. I made sure they were paid, and I really tried to take care of them and bring them gifts and just elevate them. But they taught me so much stuff in those last years of their life. And I would usually just say to them, Dasai toasagu, ita chankian hasagusakubu. So I said, what do you want your grandchildren to know? If you tell me, I will try to teach it to them. And so those were such precious moments. And so it's a bit of a balancing act to raise awareness, but to not make your own people feel guilty. I really try. Sometimes I don't try that hard. I'll just get up there and just be like, we're all just card-carrying white people now. And I'll sit down and someone said, you said you're going to be positive. I was like, yeah, that was... I don't know how that one snuck in there. So, but I do try to like really be encouraging, but it's sometimes I mix the messages up.
Oh, that made me laugh. Sorry. I absolutely resonate with what you were saying. I feel like we are very much in the same boat when it comes to attitudes around language and maybe the way our communities view safety. And I definitely feel that same frustration. I suppose one thing that I try to impart to anyone around here who will listen is, I guess there are two ways of talking about language health, and perhaps among circles of scholars and linguists and people who are able to talk about language loss in a scholarly way, there's still very much that sentiment of being concerned and being frustrated that we're not moving quickly enough, and being sort of just keenly aware of how too much positivity might transfer as complacency. I don't know if that makes sense. Like if we're too positive about it, people might get complacent. And so we don't want to do that. We want to just like, you know, keep nudging them a little bit and just say, hey, we're not in the clear yet. on the other hand, I do feel like when I'm in public, spending time with my community, spending time with my people, I observe here, and I'm not sure whether it's the same thing there, I observe that the more we share our concerns about loss with our communities, the more they think, well, that looks too hard then. Like, if you guys can't do it, then what am I going to do to help? I'll just keep living my life because, yeah, it's that. Or maybe it's that I've observed that when we're a little too negative, our communities start to go, well, okay, what do we do? It's all about the kids, right? Or it's all about the children. So we'll make them do it and we'll just be a bit more stern with the children. And I can see that that doesn't work either, because the children go, whatever you guys are doing as adults, that looks too hard. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to speak English because that's where the fun is. And so I guess I sit on this constant seesaw of, am I doing the right thing and pushing and like a message about loss or relentless positivity? And I think between my two communities, one scholarly, one, you know, community based with less of the academic background, but more of the actual do, you know, more of the actually doing every day. It's these people on the community side that I think I've just clung to relentless positivity. But people do disagree with that here, and I'm not sure how you feel, my friend, but is relentless positivity the thing to cling to? Because do I then validate that complacency of, Vinny says it's cool. Vinny says everything's great.
Right. And, you know, it's tricky because I think I saw just some silly ad on social media just this morning where it's like talking about toxic positivity. And it says, like, if you go and break your leg and you go to a doctor and the doctor says, okay, you need to go get 5 hugs every single day. And, you know, and so, but at the same time, you have people who are, it's people in peril, you know, and so the people are already, they've been beat up for generations, just the horror of colonization. And so one of the things, I was doing some work in Hawaii, and we were just sort of in this free-flowing conversation mode in a class. And I said, well, sometimes I feel like my language, it's like the Titanic, the movie, the Titanic, when the ship breaks in half and it just really sinks and all these people are in the icy waters screaming. And it's like there's a boat that's going around and with a big bullhorn yelling, why didn't you learn how to swim? You know, and so I don't want that to be me, like, because sometimes I feel like there's a real harshness there, which, you know, it's, we're hard people. Like, we've always been pretty hard people because we've had to survive in the elements. We've had to be ready to fight. And that is part of our history, but a strong part of our history is love as well. So there was an elder named Kalkawu Cyril George, and he used to tell a story. He said there was a village and these people came to raid the village one time and take people into slavery. And so there was slavery on the Northwest coast and everybody ran and they ran up into the woods. And this one man, he got away, but then he heard the cries of his son and his son had been captured. So he ran down to be captured and he'd rather be with his son as a slave than to be free without him. But he would use that as an example of love. And another one, he said, this person went to visit someone and they gave him some soup. And when he would take the soup, he would put his hand under the spoon. And they said, oh, don't burn your hand. And he said, well, I don't want to waste one drop of your love and hospitality. And so I think also that supreme love is there within our peoples. And so colonization tries to trick us. I'm sure it does this to you, where it talks about just how vicious you guys are, just warring with everybody and eating people and, you know, all kind of human sacrifice. But I think that's a trick to get us to not think about how much we love each other and how much we want to hold each other up and how that was the unifying force, I believe, and that's the unifying force that moves us forward. And so we're going to talk about this and a whole lot more, but we got to take a little break and we'll come back. So excited to be visiting with Iene across the ocean that unites us. We'll be right back. Galchish.
You struggle still today now.
a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.com.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant. Just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
One of our elders, Eto Ish Herman Davis, he used to say, he would kind of lament. He would go into this really sad moment where he'd talk about what it was like going to a boarding school and what it was like to watch the language lose all of its speakers and to see him become one of the few remaining. And he'd talk about how sad it was. And I remember Kechne Nora Downhauer should say, it's like it blew out of our hands. And she said, it's like a parachute that just got carried off into the wind. But then it was Herman Davis who said, it's echoing back now. So to be part of these language movements, I think coming back to positivity is you got to keep yourself positive as well. And sometimes relentlessly, like you were saying. And so I really appreciate you sharing a lot of that wisdom and knowledge with us here today. And you have a new platform to carry this stuff out. So I'm excited. There needs to be a lot more Indigenous people making podcasts. It's a tricky thing to talk into microphones and to edit this stuff and to put it out there. But I think we're trying to indigenize all the spaces, and podcasting is one of those spaces. So could you talk about your upcoming podcast and just tell us a little bit about it?
Kia ora, and thank you for giving me some space on your own podcast to talk about another one. For the last year and a half, perhaps, have been on a bit of a journey to talk about some of these things a little more openly with my language community than I maybe was in the past. Some of the things that I think and feel about language are not the same as my elders, and not the same as some of the really well-known people who work on my language around Aotearoa. And so I held back a lot for a while, and just recently have felt like, no, I think this line of conversation or that line of conversation needs to be heard. And if my community don't like it, they'll say so. At least they get to hear it. And so I started a platform called Mind Your Tongue, which was trying to really get people to think about how they mind their languages, their heritage languages, their ancestral languages. And I did that for a while. And then one day my fiance and I were talking. We were on this beautiful walk by the beach, and we were just having language conversations about what we idealized for our own family here and what we wanted for our lives, for our languages. And my fiance had this, like, it was such a genius idea to start a podcast that doesn't just talk about these issues that I had been feeling, you know, I guess as a language scholar and as a participant in my language, but as a family unit. And she had this idea of recentering the discussion around a home. And that was because we had been talking about things like intergenerational transmission and what it means to pass a language around your family and to different family members and what is involved in that. And I harked back to something I heard in 2017, which was, of the people in Aotearoa who could have Māori as the main language of their home, only 2.6% of them actually do. So even those who could have Māori as the main home language, 97-odd% are not doing so. Why not? Like, they should be the group of people who can, if any of us can. So what's going on there? What are the things to uncover? And just this beautiful idea kind of just permeated out from my fiancé that day about what it would look like if the two of us sat down and talked about it from the perspective of being a couple who share a family, who share a power dynamic. One is a teacher, one is more of a learner. We've had different language experiences growing up that inform how we feel now in terms of the positive and the negative language trauma that we've managed to let go of and overcome. And then after all of that, how do two people turn around and say, all right, this relationship that we have right now, I love it, but I want it to be in a different language. And what does that look like? And then we have different ancestral languages as well. I'm Māori, my fiancé is Māori and from Tokelau. How does all of that work? And so, you know, the idea for the podcast is wholly hers. We are about to finish filming season one. We are doing video and audio. We'll put little bits of it on social media. It's going to be called Two Couple Tu Kōrero. We're just jumping out there with some things that we're going to try and start talking about with our community. Are we able to change the language of our home and become part of that 2.6%? Or are we already too embedded in our ways as a home, as a family? Is there too much at play? Is there too much at stake for us as a couple to be able to kōrero in our home? So that is the trajectory of the podcast. And it will be out, we hope, around April. And it will be going up into Apple platforms, Spotify. So it should be going into all of the kind of key areas in Aotearoa where people access their podcast content. But what we really hope is that it will just spark people to think, oh, actually, I can do something positive, or even some of the things that we talk about are experiences, language experiences that aren't negative. Oh man, I just did that yesterday to my family, or I just criticized them this way, or I just corrected them this way, and actually, I'm hearing on this podcast that may not be the best way. So that is the podcast, Two Couple, Two Kōrero. Are we, aren't we? It's going to be set up in the 90s, because we're 90s kids, so all the designs are 90s. That kind of take after 90s tracksuit clothing that was popular here. I'm not sure whether it was popular over there as well. The cartoons that we were watching, it sort of like follows that trajectory. And we're so excited.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, I just got a new tracksuit just the other day. So my son is bringing it back. And so all the things that, yes, you know, everything that's retro is now, it just circles through. This is what we're hoping for our languages, is bringing them back into the home. And for Tlingit, one of the things that I noticed was we hadn't raised kids in our language for several generations, right? We go probably 60 years from the last birth speaker to the new current birth speakers that we have. And so one of the things that we realized is if your language loses all the places where it's spoken, so these domains, these social or physical spaces, one of the last strongholds is usually the ceremony. And so one of the things I think that happens is your language, every language act becomes an act of ceremony, which means your language is not going to be used on a day-to-day basis. Because once you start raising kids and stuff, you have to start saying, you know, wipe their butt, and did you go to the bathroom, and did you poop your pants, and you got to go to the bathroom here. And so there's a lot of stuff that you don't usually say this stuff to adults, right? And so what happens as well is that becomes very jarring for even some of our elders. They said, we don't use our language that way. And I said, but how did people learn how to do all this stuff, like just going to the bathroom and taking care of yourself? And there must have been ways, because every language functions like that. There's stuff that you do inside the home that's different than what you do outside of the home. And so what we've had to do is reconstruct some of that stuff. One of the things that did happen with our language was not just an enormous amount of language loss, But then some of the folks who came to start documenting our language were missionaries. And so the missionaries, it kind of depended on those individuals. Like, how much did they want to wipe everything out and replace it? And how much did they want to sort of incorporate it into Christianity, basically? And so we were fortunate here that some of the main missionaries that we had that did a lot of language work, they were okay with the language existing. That's what it seems like when you read their materials. They weren't trying to convert everything, but they also just have a strong sense of maybe embarrassment when it comes to pooping and peeing and sexual activity. And so all of that stuff is absent. So I remember one of my mentors was talking about this verb dictionary in Tlingit, and he said, they got all of them. They got all the verbs. I said, well, this book is wonderful, but they did not get all of the verbs. And he says, well, what do you mean? I says, well, if I just use this, I can't poop, I can't pee, I can't make more people. And my aunties and uncles, they taught me how to say all that stuff. And so the other thing is trying to get back to a whole language. And so whole language means we have to re-envision what our language even is. And what our language is, it's a method to communicate everything, everything about the world and everything about ourselves and everything about our peoples. And then also the challenge that we found is, and I thought of this because a legislator said, when we're talking about language and education, indigenous languages and education, and she said, well, how do you balance the ancient of the Alaska Native language and the modern of English? And I thought, okay, I don't want to laugh at this question. But it's also, so I said, well, okay, there's a bit of a stereotype here that I just want to point out. It's that English is modern and Alaska Natives are ancient. And there's some dangerous stuff with us being frozen in time. But there's also some reality there because our language was actively banished. There was a war on our language for 80 years. So we weren't allowed to be part of the conversation about science and technology and everything that's going on. And so we didn't have a chance to make the words that everyone else has made words for this. There's so many words in English that didn't exist 100 years ago where you could go back and it's not just stuff on social media. It's a lot of science and technology concepts. If you just hopped into a time machine and went to 1880 and said, how many gigabytes is that? They would look at you like you're crazy. And so same thing for indigenous languages. We have been prohibited from these spaces. So I'm so excited about your podcast because these are the topics that we also need is how do you get the language back home? Because remember, we would focus a lot on teaching it through the university and teaching it through the elementary schools and the high schools and the preschools. And some of our own people would say, that's not it. You got to get it into the home. I said, yes, but it's not a one thing or the other. We have to teach people the language so they can bring it home. We can't just say everybody speaks Tlingit at home because nobody speaks it. 20 years ago, maybe grandma and grandpa did, but now hardly anybody. And so it's not so limited that we only pick one spot. Like, we got to bring it back everywhere. So I'm excited. I'm excited about the podcast. How has it been recording episodes and cutting them up and doing that kind of stuff?
Oh my gosh, there's so much that you just said that I would just love to dive into. I'll start with the podcast and then I feel like if we can come back to it, that's so great. Things that you were talking about, I was just thinking about something you say is language is treasure, language is taonga, and I guess considering what else might be treasure to us. So you've got your ceremonial language, which is that language that you hold so tightly, closely, but then seeing something else like a mug, a drink bottle, a knife, a fork, seeing all of those things as treasures too that are functional every day. And what kind of language is encapsulated in the mug, the fork, and the toilet paper, all of those beautiful things. It's been such a cool process working on this podcast together. It's been a lot of fun. We decided because it was home-based that we would record it all in our lounge. We wouldn't go into a studio. We wouldn't use any online platforms for this season. We would sit in our lounge with all of the stuff that comes with that, like garbage trucks outside being noisy and the cat being just an absolute pain everywhere she goes. If she sees a camera stand or a tripod holding a phone or a camera, she'll go and try and knock it over because it's new and exciting. And so all of those things we thought would be, fun. So I'm sitting in my lounge at the moment, and this is where we recorded it. We wanted it to be really based, centered around ourselves and how we are as a couple, and we wanted to be silly and say nerdy things. And so we decided to do that. And when we got to interviewing guests, we also tried to keep that as much as possible. So we did interview some guests, one couple who are raising their family in both Māori and Tongan. And then we wanted to step just outside of the Pacific. So we interviewed some friends of my fiance, Sri Lankan. And we wanted to talk to all of these people about how do you reinstate intergenerational transmission. But we wanted to step into the reality of it. I think a lot of us, when we think about intergenerational transmission, we just think about the one target language. But the reality is for us as a couple, we've got at least two to think about, Te Reo Māori and Tokelau. For our Te Reo Māori Tongan family, we saw that as being a beautiful example of how do you actually do that? Got multiple languages going on. What happens? You know, how do you think? How do you feel? What are all the beautiful code switching moments that your children are making? So that was great. From the perspective of the Sri Lankan whānau, we wanted to know, well, you are New Zealand born, or you've been here, living here for a long time. You've got children. You've got parents still here with you. How have you managed to maintain your language transmission as an intergenerationally transmitting family on the same lands that I am, and we're breathing the same air, we experience the same or similar kinds of oppression from the outside, we have the same external factors, we have the same English pressure, how have you managed to dodge it? Because we've talked about this so much, and Māori communities talk about this so much every day. How do you do it? How do we get over it? How do we get over this hump? How do we stop this from happening? How do we control it? And do you guys even talk about this? I'm not even sure that you do. So, you know, we got to sit down with them and say, do you actually talk about it? They're like, no. And then, you know, so we get through the podcast and they're like, now we will. But, you know, for me, it was like seeing that, no, these families are maintaining their languages. They are not giving their languages up to anybody. And it feels so comfortable the way that they move in and out of languages and where they don't accommodate, you know. So like for myself as a stranger to the family, they don't accommodate me, and that's something that Māori communities often struggle with, because we come from a background of hospitality, so we want to accommodate, you know, we want you to feel comfortable. And I think we've got to a point in time, and certainly after seeing that family, talking to them, seeing how they maintain their languages without accommodating me, and I didn't feel uncomfortable. It's beautiful. I love it. I still felt welcome. I still felt all of the hospitality. I'm thinking, man, maybe we accommodate too much, and maybe that's a barrier. So all these little things are just, you know, amazing. So working on the podcast has been beautiful. Going out to their home, otherwise sitting at home, cutting it together, you know, from afar with a team of people who are just awesome. Beautiful company, Māori owned production company called Ata. They do amazing stuff. It's been so much fun.
Fabulous. And we need more indigenous voices that are out there. And looking at around the world, there are so many languages that are trying to do the exact same thing. Like it's a different language and it's a different situation, but it's a similar thing where a group of people have come and tried to destroy your language and tried to replace it with something else. And so trying to sort of now look and say, okay, well, we could do both. That's okay. But then trying to sort of redefine some of these spaces and sometimes redefine some of these relationships. Like, so if you said, okay, well, now we're going to do this all in Tlingit. And so my wife and I, we decided when our babies were born that I would speak to them entirely in Tlingit. And it was, for myself, it was a huge challenge just to look at this little baby and think, what am I going to say to you, baby? Like, what now? And so it's, you know, because so much of my language journey had been, how are you? Good. How are you? Good. How's the weather? Fine. And then, you know, then switching to English after that, it's like a handshake language. And so having these babies and then really talking to them and then seeing that they can communicate just fine. It's like whatever language you pick, and you could pick multiple languages and they'll be just fine. And so we're going to talk about a lot more of this when we come back. We're going to take our second break. I'm so excited to hear about your podcast. I'm so looking forward to listening to it. And I'm so glad that you folks are making it. So, Kunchish, we'll be right back. Hey,
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant. Just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
When Kalin's cook Jayaha Yagu. Aka tik deni jagatune wujin. Atuasagu kedenia nathritia ya hayagu. Ye awa wujin yejitune ye kwati. Chatlaikia na teach. So sometimes, folks, our canoe runs aground. And when it runs aground, it takes a lot of work to get that canoe back in the water and going again. We have a verb for something like that, for a canoe to run aground or for a car to get stuck. It'd be the same verb. And then people got to work real hard to get that canoe back in the water. But we have another verb which talks about when everybody's really paddling, just completely synchronized and paddling with such rhythm and strength that canoe just starts gliding across the water. So that's our metaphor for this next part of our conversation, which is when you get stuck as an individual and when you get stuck as a collective, what's the next step? And these are always things, if you're working in indigenous languages, odds are you're probably just up every night trying to figure out the next thing you're trying to solve in terms of how do I make this easier for people? How do I make this more incentivized? How do I bring the people back? How do I get the people to care more deeply and to be more committed? But also, how do I help heal the people? And how do I heal myself? Because maybe I'm being mean to people, just overcorrection or correcting with meanness. You know, one time we were learning a lot from our Hawaiian language teacher, and he teased us all the time and sometimes would just correct us kind of harshly, but laughing. And we were all in the same sort of space that it wasn't offensive. It wasn't hurtful. It was all in good fun. And I think I came back and maybe tried that, but I was maybe upset and I was frustrated that someone didn't know something. And I really hurt their feelings by the way that I corrected them. And I'm not trying to blame it on anybody, but sometimes the energies that we bring, we might not understand in our own selves how that can be harmful sometimes. And so some of the areas that I think about is like, what's next for us? Because if we look at Maori, for Tlingit people, we're usually like, they got it. They figured it all out. They've done the thing. We just have to be like them. But I'm sure if I came among you, it would probably be something else, like who has figured it out? We're stuck on this thing. And so when you're in the woods, it's hard to see the forest. And then when you're in the forest, you know, sometimes it's hard to see where to go next. So I want to ask you your thoughts on where things are at, sort of with the collective, with you and as an individual, and what your current strategies are on getting that canoe back in the water and getting that speed up again.
Kia ora, that's an awesome intro. I was thinking while you were talking, we have a proverb that's sort of similar e moana pukepuke ka ekingia e te waka, and it is about the collective, but it's sort of like choppy waters can still be used as gliding waters if everybody's paddling in unison. And that's kind of the crux of that proverb. And I think that really harks back to where we are at in our language situation. I've often heard on my travels with international communities that they look to my language as a, I guess, a point of inspiration. And I think you're right. It might be that I'm not seeing the forest for the trees, potentially. I know that there are things about our language journey that have been different from the colonial experience of others, which means that the forms of oppression have been different. There are some, I mean, I would never say lucky, but there are some parts about our colonial history and settler colonial history here in that I have observed are less intense than what other languages have undergone or other cultures have undergone. That's not luck. I don't know what you'd call it. But it means that a lot of people look to our language and think, man, those people have it sorted. And I just think we just happened to be in a different part of the world at a later period of time, that by the time Cook arrived and all of these horrific things started happening, colonial powers had become a little more conscientized and a little more enlightened than they were previously. And so that's the, if there's any luck in it, it's that distance and time. We have been, in some respects, so I use that word luck, like just for complete lack of a better term. Our language came to a point where it was one generation away from having no native speakers in about the 1970s, which is quite a lot later than other languages that I've visited. By that time, we were able to talk with other communities and see what they'd been through. You know, this is the 1970s. There's opportunities to talk across the water, across the seas. And so we were learning. And so while people often talk about Māori being, you know, this or that in language revitalization, I often look at it the other way and think, well, we had the opportunity to talk with you and feel your pain and feel the things that you have been going through. And so I credit our inspiration to international Indigenous people teaching us. We, at the moment, are in this groundswell of positive movement, which I feel so hopeful. There's a downside to that, but at the moment, there's just this groundswell of people who want to engage with this language. Ahakoa iti, ahakoa nui, whether it's a little bit or a lot, the whole nation really is banding around the language at the moment in a really beautiful way, and that is really hopeful and really positive. Of course, up against that, we have the current political climate, which is, I don't think, unique to Aotearoa New Zealand, where we're seeing the most right-wing extremist governments around the world in colonized spaces. And those settler colonial governments are far more extreme than we've probably maybe ever seen in quite some time, or seen on our own land. We're certainly experiencing that. And so there are some moves to try and take away from the language, the ground that has been made in recent memory. One of the things that I cling to is that it's been a lot of non-Māori people who are pushing it forward anyway for us, and so I'm thankful for that. We're still in a space where we don't have enough speakers, where we don't have enough people who are really trying to work on our language in the home. We're still sitting somewhere around that, you know, that low percentage of people who are speaking the language every day. And so as part of that, I think a lot of us who work with families and different cultural spaces and even workplaces and schools, and we sit down and we talk about language, some themes are certainly starting to emerge that I'm quite keen for us to explore, if not change. And a couple of them are like really hard, I think, to grapple with. And I think the reason they're hard to grapple with is that I feel like I almost start sounding at times like I'm really like pro-English, and it's hard, I think, to dissect that. And one example is like bilingualism and centering our language efforts around bilingualism. I think I've learned that centering our language efforts wholly around Māori, while it has some good positive benefits, it has some downsides. And one of them is, like you gestured to it before, around like really overt correction, because people love the language, people love it. And they hold it so dear. It's a treasure. And that can mean when somebody makes a mistake or does something that they don't think is quite native or natural, that there's quite heavy criticism that comes along with that, because they feel like their treasure has been something's happened to it. Professor Rawinia Higgins here in Aotearoa calls it the golem effect. It's like the more you sit with your treasure, the more it kind of just starts to change your thinking into that like unwavering need to protect it against all costs, even at the expense of itself. And so I feel like that's part of this possibly like clinging so carefully to Māori, is that every time somebody does something that we don't think is quite there, it will come with that sort of really heavy, heavy criticism. Some of those things that people do are really, really natural, normal behaviors of a bilingual or a multilingual. You know, there's billions of multilinguals all around the world, and they're all doing these things. And so I started to think, I'm not sure whether clinging to this, like, golem is actually paying off for us. I think we need to explore about what life might be like if we center our revival around being excellent bilinguals, amazing multilinguals, and how freeing that could be for us. And I think I've observed that as I've started talking about it among people who don't currently speak Māori or are still learning. They get that, it resonates with them. So there's kind of those little things. That hasn't always gone down well. There's a certain pocket of society, who are not keen on that idea because of what it allows in. You know, we have to make space for English if we're going to center revival around multilingualism. That's scary. And I understand that. I'm not disagreeing. But I think that at the moment, it's that need for us to just step out a little bit, like you say, and have a look at the forest itself and think, well, we spent 50 years chasing the Māori language everywhere all the time. There's no room for error. We've done that for quite a while. And if that's contributed to us sort of being in this space where we still don't have our critical mass, perhaps it's time to change something. So that's kind of the angle that I come from today. And I wouldn't say that that's always been my belief. I'm a bit of a famous language purist of old. I would call myself a recovering language purist. And I'll share one quick story about when I was younger learning Māori, and I had learned that it was bad to have transliterations from English. We should have our own words, because to mix languages, that's so bad. It's such a terrible thing to do. It really affects the life of a language, and we need to stop doing it. And that's what I had been fed as a language attitude. And anyway, I went to my ancestral marae, my ancestral home, at aged 22 for the first time. And I'd been learning Māori for about 4 years at that point. It's the first time I'd ever been exposed to my ancestry, my whakapapa, my ancestral meeting house, my lands. And I learned that my great-great-grandfather adopted a surname, the first one to adopt a surname, and he adopted a transliteration for Friday, Paraire. And so here was me talking about how transliterations were bastardizing my language and all of this, you know, holding those attitudes, and then realizing that quite literally the most proficient native speaker that my family has ever had in recent memory adopted one as his name. And I think what that really taught me that day was the language attitudes that people hold are not necessarily language attitudes that feed the health of a language. And I really started to challenge all of my language attitudes at that point, because I wanted the language attitudes that made speakers, that created people who felt comfortable to push their identity in little ways that included the language in them. And I started to realize that some of the attitudes that the language community held, I didn't think fed the language like they could. And I wanted the ones that fed it. I wanted those things that made people wake up in the morning and think, yeah, this language history that we've had is horrific. But I don't have to sit and wallow in that. I can feel that and move through it at the same time. I can process it, feel sad about it, and reclaim it at the same time. And it was little inklings of things like language attitudes around transliteration, and there's a bunch of others that we have for our language that really made me question that. Ever since then, I started to realize that I think what's holding us back in Aotearoa New Zealand is our pursuit of language attitudes that really, truly feed us, that allow us to move past the golem effect, to see our language as treasure, but that treasure is not just the treasure of the museum that you put it in the case and you look at it. It's the treasure that you eat with. It's the treasure that you use every day, those meaningful things and the attitudes that surround them. And that's where I would love for our people to be considering, to be thinking, to be sitting at that table having those discussions. But as I say, whether that's something that actually does last the distance, I'm not sure. I mean, there are people who think like that too, but there are definitely people who are like, no, it's got to be, you know, we need to not let space, we need to not let English. And I actually do understand those as well. So yeah, we've got those trajectories going on, and who knows what will happen. Yeah.
Yeah, well. I want to thank you so much, Yene Vinnie Olson Reader. I'm looking forward to your podcast coming out. And when you connect with someone as far as like ideologies and approaches and stuff, it's so exciting, but also feels like this is just going to be episode one of 99. And so we could keep going, but we're going to have to wrap this show up. So one thing I was thinking of, there's an elder named Charlie Joseph who was doing a lot of work here. He's gone now. He's been gone for quite some time. He was Ka Guantan. He was in the Shitka, Sitka area. And at one point he has said, and the translation for that is, from long ago, we have held our grandchildren up above ourselves. Yes, we cherish them. Even these things that we don't want to share, we offer up to them, the ones who will become our grandchildren. And I think of that because, yeah, the Gollum effect. Like, I was just sitting here trying to think of how could I do, you know, like some kind of Gollum voice or something. But to just say, sometimes you can clutch it so tight that it feels like other people can't get a piece of this thing. And then sometimes you end up not sharing things and you hide things. And or you end up saying to people, if you can't say it right, don't say it at all, which is sometimes just shutting the whole thing down. And I don't think that's people's intentions, but there's so much fear, there's so much loss, there's so much on the line that I think we really got to create these spaces where we say, you know what? There's no mistakes. It's all just learning. It's all part of learning in this journey. And we have confidence in ourselves. We have confidence in each other, and we have confidence in you that we can get it corrected over time. And the biggest thing right now is just use and becoming familiar with this thing that has been taken with us at such an immense level that it becomes a foreign object to our own peoples. And to renaturalize ourselves within our language, I do think takes acts of medicinal purpose, of healing, of unity, of just saying, you can do the thing, and you should do the thing, and you can do the thing, and you will do the thing. And as we move forward together, we reach our hands out across the ocean, we reach our hands out across the internet, and we say, oh, you guys are doing the thing. Yeah, we're doing the thing. These are different things, but there's so many similarities. And a lot of those similarities are in how do we keep the thing growing at this rate that sometimes seems impossible. But I think that impossible is a colonial construct. And I think that indigenous futures are the things that we continue to focus on. So Gunalchish, I'm really looking forward to your podcast coming out. We'll put the title in the description, and in future episodes, we'll put a link out when it does come out. So Gunalchish, for being with us, and for all of you out there doing the language work, keep on going. Believe in yourself, believe in each other. Take a little break when you need a little break. Give someone else a break when they need a break. And just remember the collective vision of creating a space reserved for future generations. The Tongue Unbroken is a project of the Next Up Initiative. Check out other podcasts on iHeartMedia Network. And check out Indigenous peoples making podcasts all around the world and taking control of media and putting our voices out there. Gunalchish Tlein.
Kia ora.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union, a savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables. Ooh, yum. And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notified, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.